Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse here at Advise Health. Retired Senior Special Agent from the OIG and doing a lot of training and education for Advise. I'm joined, as always, by my two partners in crime, Wade McFall. If you're from the New York area, it's Wade McFall, because I don't really understand this all piece. But
you know what? It's funny, though, Eric. I got to say, this has come up a few times. I have quite a bit of family that live in New York, in Manhattan, in Connecticut. It's not McFall there either.
It's not. McFall, I mean, it's people always pronounce my name Rubenstein because it's actually spelled Rubenstein, but spelled Rubenstein. I said, look, this is what they told me. I didn't make it up. So, yeah. But you know, whatever, tomato, tomato, as long as the eagle flies, right? So yeah. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent charge from the LA field office, and a manager on our SIU investigative team. And of course, Matt Kachansky, bringing it home today as always, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director, and the payment integrity director here at Advise, and hopefully looking to see the Washington Capitals have a stellar season this year.
And it's pronounced Kochanski in Poland.
Okay, well, you know, guess what? We're not in Poland. So, you know, we're here in the Northeast. And that's, we're going to call you Kachansky. You can call yourself Kochanski after hours, but during business hours, my podcast,
my rules.
So, all right. So today we want to talk, again, the press releases over the summer, you know, typically during the summer, you think that there's a little bit of a slowdown, and oftentimes there is, but there have been some really good press releases the past few weeks. And the one that we're going to talk about this week looks like an indictment that came out of Detroit, Michigan, Detroit Rock City, involving a company called Fast Labs Technologies. It looks like the indictment doesn't give a time period, but this is a COVID-19 testing fraud scheme. We're going to guess that it's, you know, the time period is going to be sometime post March of 2020 through probably 23 or 24, give or take, so a few years. It's a little bit difficult to tell from the press release about exactly what Fast Labs Technologies actually was doing. The name does not seem to comport with what they were doing. It appears that they were running a sham website for the purposes of gathering information for people to provide their contact information and their insurance under the guise of free COVID tests. Now, for those of you that remember, if you have a short memory, please don't ever forget what was going on during the PHE. But there were two different types of tests that were out there. There was the rapid test, which was the, you know, typically the at-home type test, or you could go to a pop-up facility if you didn't have the test, and you can get a rapid, or you can get what's known as the PCR, which is the lab test. The PCR was the one that required a day or two to get the results because it was on a machine and it was a little bit more specific. The rapid test had some failure rates to it. And the rapid tests, for those of you that remember, there were several steps to do the test. And if you didn't get the steps right, or you didn't swab your nose for enough time to get enough material, you could have a false positive or a false negative. So the other piece is that with these tests, you are only entitled so first of all, if it was an over-the-counter test, you were entitled to get 8 a month free, right? And if everybody remembers, there was a website that was set up, you would order them, and then they would be delivered by U.S. Postal Service, and you'd get your 8 tests a month. And then that was the end of that. If you were a commercial insurer, or in the early days when Medicare wasn't really covering them, you could go and you could buy them and then send a reimbursement form in. There were a bunch of ways. But the bottom line is that you had either 8 at-home tests or you can get tests in a lab, but you couldn't get a rapid from a lab. You couldn't get a rapid test and a PCR test in the same day unless you had a specific order from a doctor for the PCR test after you've had the rapid. So a common situation would be that you went to an urgent care center, they did a rapid test, your rapid test came up inconclusive or negative, but you had other signs and symptoms that led the doctor or the PA or the NP or whomever was treating you to believe that you had COVID, and they would want you to get a lab PCR test. So they would have to write an actual order providing medical necessity for why you needed the PCR test after the rapid test was already done and paid for. And so you couldn't get them both on the same day. So what labs would do during the PHE in order to manipulate and get paid is they would just play a game with the dates. because as long as it wasn't the same date of service, you can get reimbursed for it. What it looks like with Fast Labs Technology was doing was they had a website that was set up, and the website was offering free tests, and they were mailing tests to the recipients. And they were asking for insurance information in order to submit claims. And at the end of the day, about $500 million was paid out or was billed out. It doesn't, the indictment doesn't really expressly tell that, but it's a $500 million fraud. The PCR tests reimbursed anywhere between 50 and 100 bucks over the counter, reimbursed at about 12 bucks a test. So we're talking about an inordinate volume, you know, for this. And again, this is an indictment. So this is not the final, this is just the indictment. This is the charge. And so you have a lot of money in just a few years. And there are a couple of key points. And Wade, I want to go to you first on this one, because so a couple of things from the press release. One, it appears that one doctor was behind most of these tests as the referring or ordering doctor. Huge volume. And the press release discusses the common thread in a lot of these kinds of cases, lack of relationship with the doctor patient. And I think, you know, we talked about that as being not really a huge issue in the big picture, because we're talking about these tests and there were probably 100 other ways that people could have gotten these tests anyway. So it's still a factor, because you're talking about him being the only one for all of these. But these red flags, you know, we've been talking about these red flags incessantly for months, and how these red flags pop up in the data constantly, and how we have our hindsight is 2020, but also from an investigative perspective, we look at this and we say, why didn't this get caught? So wait, I know we sound like a broken record, you know, with this, but there are so many things in this that give obviously pause as to why. But the other piece of this, so I want to start with the first part I want to talk about, is in the press release, they named every agency that possibly exists in the government that could have, would have, or should have thought about, touched, or been involved with anything involving COVID. The list of agencies, I don't think I've seen a press release that had a list of agencies like this in a very long time that didn't involve a ton of defendants, RICO type cases, very complicated healthcare fraud cases. But I think I counted somewhere in the area of 6 to 10 agencies, even non-law enforcement agencies through Department of Labor who do regulatory investigative work. And some criminal kind of tangential work, but Postal Inspection Service, Medicaid Fraud Control Unit for Michigan, obviously HHS, OIG, 12 agencies. I can't fathom 12 agencies. It never ceases to amaze me. So the first issue, Wade, is if you're in the SIU and you see, you know, you hear 12 agencies and something like this, you know, and you've got a case. And there's a large dollar amount, right? So you got to think about like querying the NHCA's database, right? CIRIS and that law enforcement. So let's start with the fact that from the COVID perspective, knowing that there's a very large spotlight on a lot of the COVID cases, this is a great example of why if you're at a payer and you're in the SIU and you have a case involving a COVID testing and you're starting to uncover some of these things, this is where, right, like your law enforcement liaison, your database checks, you know, looking at NHCAA, like you have to start with that and then talk about, you know, like, I don't want to be rude when I say, well, the data just horseshit, right? At this point now, like, you just got to think, like, what is going on here?
Right. Well, you're right. There was every agency known to me involved in this, and it's because of the wide, you know, exposure of this type of test. Everybody was building them. So this comes back to what we've talked to many times, and that's having either a formal like law enforcement liaison or at least something informal where you have somebody in the SIU who can be in contact with, you know, an OIG agent, a Mofuku agent, whoever, that they have, you know, somebody on their Rolodex that they can call for these types of things. Because the U.S. Attorney's Office and the major healthcare investigative agencies have, you know, quarterly meetings where everybody who might remotely touch Medicare, Medicaid, you know, medical fraud, gets together and compares notes, talks about the bigger cases or trends and things of that nature. And this no doubt was brought up in one of those meetings, and all these agencies thought, oh, we're probably getting billed for that as well. So they went back, ran some numbers, they want in on it because it's going to be a big dollar amount. If you don't have somebody like that within your SIU, you're not going to really be aware of the bigger picture on this. It's almost like a task force that's addressing these tests. So you won't know about it. If you have that liaison, whether it's somebody that's part of their official duties, or you just have somebody that you occasionally reach out to, you know, they may let you know, hey, you might want to come to this meeting, or we had this meeting and this is a big project we're working. So you know to look for those types of exposures.
And the just to interrupt you for a second. So when I saw this press release, the thing that struck me was the fact that this was a known, this entity was known, you know, from some of the people that I'm in contact with along the way. This wasn't a this wasn't like an out of the blue one. But, you know, until you know that there's an indictment, maybe you don't know to have that conversation. Right. So you're in an SIU and you're working on this and you're like, oh, this seems kind of weird. And, you know, I'm in New York and this lab is based out of Michigan. You know, maybe I should be making some phone calls. Right. So that becomes part that becomes part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And what you don't want to happen is to hear about this in the press release after action has been taken and you've missed the boat where you could have, you know, staked your claim or helped out and at least run the numbers and give them, you know, I'm sure when they're working this kind of as a project, if your SIU could say, oh, by the way, we have exposure of another $100,000 or whatever, they'd be happy to add that to the $5 million or $500 million. So right. You want to get on it early so you can be part of the whole process.
So I want to get back to you in a second on the data, because I want to go to Matt for a minute and not to be able to rush him off because I know he has to get to something else soon. But I want to get to Matt on something and then go back to you about the data. Yeah. So, Matt, this becomes part and parcel to this whole conversation of what do you do? A press release comes out, and in that press release, the entity that you currently have an open SIU case on, you find is now indicted. And as a commercial payer seeing this, you're at a crossroads. Do you just keep going and do your thing? Do you reach out to the law enforcement organizations, try to get them in? Like, you know, you become a rock in a hard place, not by your own choosing.
Absolutely. It's a difficult situation to be in because you've got your own plans, vulnerabilities and losses that you're looking at versus a very large, complex task force of an approach here that's got to the point of charging these people for $50 million in fraud. You as an SIU, you've got a choice, continue or not, or also contact the agencies. You don't want to compromise anything that the federal government is doing in terms of preparing their case by conducting interviews or looking at data and coming up with different findings than what the government is coming up with and sending different findings to the defendant at this point. So, but at the same time, you want to protect yourself. So you've got to make the decision. Call the U.S. Attorney's Office, call their victim witness coordinator and say, look, we're looking at this. We have a loss. We want to move forward. What steps can or cannot we take? Or can we simply give you our loss amounts and all the information we have, and you will make it part of your case, at least a settlement or sentencing, and wait on that and just kind of pend it until there? Or you just go ahead, do it, and let the cards lay where they lay at the end, and you know, you make yourself whole. That's an incredibly difficult decision to make. And you've got other factors involved. You've got your board of directors giving you direction. You've got the compliance people giving you direction. And then you've got your SIU investigators. Some of them might be former law enforcement saying, you can't do that.
Right. Yeah, it is. You're certainly at a crossroads, because the question then becomes, if you reach out, and this is where, you know, having those contacts, you know, maybe you're in Florida and you don't have a contact in Detroit, but you have a contact in Florida, that's the way you start, right? If you have a someone that you can reach out to eventually have that conversation, if you need to have that conversation. Because at the end of the day, the challenge, which you brought up, is if you continue to do your investigation, are you going to create a problem for the government's investigation, right? What if you interviewed someone who has exculpatory statements, and ultimately those exculpatory statements become discoverable later on in something, because maybe the government goes and interviews someone later on, you know, inconsistency in statements and things of that sort. This is a huge challenge. And I think, you know, the problem is that you're trying to protect your, you know, the SIU, the goal is to protect the plan money, and you've got this case, and how do you continue to protect? Do you protect that money by getting the government to roll your case into theirs? Do you protect your program by just going on your own and just saying, you know, our case doesn't involve this $500 million. It's all government money. It's a challenge to kind of figure out where you're going to, you know, what you're going to do. I think this happens more often than not.
It does.
And it's just not addressed.
It happens a lot. And what happens sometimes is the defendant will then say, well, look, I settled with these people administratively for 50 cents on the dollar. Why am I being charged criminally for the same actions?
Well, and, you know, that brings up a great point. And, you know, let's take this back. When we were all at the OIG and we would have a case that would be referred to us from typically the UPIC, where they did an administrative recovery of the money and then made a referral, most U.S. attorney's offices had no appetite to take it, because they would say, you treated this as an administrative overpayment. You clearly didn't think that this had a level of criminality or FCA or whatever it may be. And so that is a real piece of the puzzle. And obviously the government's interests are a little bit different, may not be aligned, where the government's going to come back and say, hey, look, we didn't even know that XYZ plan was doing this. And that's up to them. We're talking about our things, not theirs, right? So there's going to be hoops and arguments and discussions, but it's certainly something that you have to consider in determining what you're going to do. You obviously don't want, if you've got a dollar that's owed, you obviously want to try to, you know, collect that dollar or get your percentage on that dollar back. But this is one of those things where, you know, you've got to really consider what are the pros, what are the cons of doing something like this? Where is there a benefit, and, you know, where do you run a risk? You know, I can tell you that the minimum is going to be that if you sought to do this case on your own and you were successful on a quick recovery, you're probably going to lose some friends in the law enforcement community that do healthcare fraud cases, right? And then at the same time, if you shut the case down and at the end of the day, the government gets its pound of flesh, whatever that may be, and there's no money left, you're out holding the bag on that money anyway, and you're not there. So, you know, there's a little bit of a line that has to be drawn. I think the recommendation would be that, you know, just kind of going on your own without at least discussing with law enforcement, because at the end of the day, you may discuss it with law enforcement and it may not change anything. You may not discuss it with law enforcement and it might not change anything, but you might not discuss it with law enforcement and it might destroy everything that you're working on. So, you know, there is a fine line to have these kind of conversations internally. And if you've got contacts to kind of, you know, check them out, I think this is probably one of the biggest challenges in the SIU space. You know, clearly when you've got an indictment and you're working on a case involving a provider, there's a lot of smoke there, right? There's obviously been something to show from an indictment perspective. And I think that's where bringing in the leadership of your SIU becomes more important than ever. The minute that you find out that there is a indictment or an investigation going on involving a government agency and the prospect of there being an FCA case or law enforcement for a criminal case, you've got to make some decisions very quickly on how you're going to resolve that.
And where resources allow, it shows the benefit of having a law enforcement liaison and perhaps ongoing communication and dialogue with the local law enforcement agencies, where you wouldn't find out about it at indictment, you might find out about it while it's being developed.
Right. So Wade, I want to go back to you for kind of the final thoughts as we wrap up, which is the data. And, the data should have, this is not anything different, right? Single source of referrals, large volume for tests that, you know, may or may not have had a medical necessity to them. Like some of these flags are just there. I think the problem, and, you know, we've looked at some of these policies that are out there. The problem is that the policies were so ever evolving and changing, right? So what's right and what's wrong at the time. And it kind of gets back to, you've got to know what the policies are during the relevant time period of what you're looking at.
Right. And when we talk about the data, I think we're talking about, you know, we always talk about the flags that we see, and most of them are data related. A few are maybe not as much. In this case, like, medical necessity is almost always an issue in these types of cases. In this one, it's, I would say, less so, just because of the public health emergency. Everybody had kind of built in medical necessity, as far as everyone had, they could get like 8 of these tests a week. So you didn't have to, you know, show that you had symptoms or anything. You could just
get eight tests a month.
A month.
You could test twice a week. Yeah.
So the medical necessity part, which isn't really, a lot of times that can be a flag, but it's not readily available in data, but that's kind of a non-issue here. The no prior relationship, we can see that in the data, and it's, we had talked before, at first glance, to me, it didn't seem as relevant as it normally is, because again, they can just order these tests. But the fact that for the whole universe here, almost all of them, and I may even say, I think that was all of them, came from the one doctor. And that's a huge red flag. $500 million worth of tests that are relatively low dollar. We don't know the breakdown on the rapid versus the PCR tests, but that's a lot of tests to get to that amount. And for them all to be from one doctor is a definite flag, that kind of volume and high dollar. The other is, we had discussed a little bit, before we started this call, but for the rapid tests, there was like a standing order. So like a physician like this, we discussed how they wouldn't have all these specific orders for each test, but in the drive-through, the rapid, the antigen tests, there was a standing order where the ordering official was a State Department of Health official. So it wasn't your typical family practice physician type of thing. Because of the public health emergency, there was a standing order for these types of tests in the rapid tests, the drive-through type situation. So that appeared to be a flag in my mind, probably less so because of these standing orders. But the biggest one is the fact that, and one other that doesn't show up in the data, but the whole, we could have another conversation and have before on any time you tell someone it's free, but we need your insurance card.
Right.
That's like an educational thing for members and for banks, because that should be, huge.
One of the things, the press release didn't have it. I would have loved to have learned what the time frame was for this, because the time frame is going to be a little bit relevant. But during the PHE, right, you could get a rapid test, you can get the PCR test. You really didn't need a doctor's order for it. And then the public health emergency goes away, and, you know, maybe you need a doctor's order for some of these. You can go and buy the COVID-19 test over the counter. And I haven't gone and had one done through a lab, since the public health emergency. So, you know, I think there's probably a question about, do you need that order? Do you not need that order? But, you know, obviously the red flag in kind of the global sense is one doctor being the ordering physician for these PCR tests. The PCR tests are about $100 anywhere between $50 and $100 is what they were going for, versus the over-the-counter ones are $12. I think, look, the big take-home, Wade, is if it's free, but they're asking you for your insurance information, the answer that they'll give is, well, it really is free because patients didn't have a financial encumbrance, right? So the argument of the word free is going to be an odd one, because the argument is going to be there was no cost sharing, at least during the PHE, there was no cost sharing, and it's a lab test. And for those that don't know, in the Medicare program, for the most part, Laboratory services are reimbursed at 100% of the Medicare fee schedule. They're not reimbursed at 80% of the allowed amount. In the normal course of business, there's an 80-20. The 20% encumbrance is the financial responsibility of the patient or secondary insurance. But in lab tests, there's typically a 100% of the fee schedule reimbursement. So there's an argument that I think they would be making that it is free to them, and that in order for them to make it free, they had to bill insurance. So the argument is going to be that you misrepresented the nature of it to the public. But the argument that the defense can likely make is, at the end of the day, we weren't misrepresenting this to the public. It is free to the member, and we have to pay for this through the government, through billing insurance, because we're not getting, you know, we're not billing this through the HRSA program for uninsured or what have you. So there's a lot of twists and turns, I think, to something that kind of stands out as being a straightforward one. We'll see what happens. $500 million. And by the way, they were indicted. They weren't charged by a complaint, which meant that they went through the grand jury process. And so obviously, when you've got 12 agencies involved, they obviously believe they have a strong case that has some other indicias of fraud that we may not see in the press release. You know, obviously a website calling it free, but asking for the insurance information for people. And then the argument, according to the press release, was that a lot of these tests weren't even performed. It actually looks like the name of the place was Fast Labs Technologies, but were they even really a lab, or were they just a website, a shell? We saw that a lot during the PHE. We see that a lot with diabetic testing supplies, like, you know, the use of technology as a social engineering tools is prevalent. And so people, you know, nobody says no to free, right? Nobody says no to free. So interesting.
This was like a lot of the cases back in Los Angeles where we try and educate the Bennies, the members, that, you know, once, and you have to give your insurance your insurance number to providers and stuff. That's part of, you know, the whole healthcare system. But when you get the unscrupulous providers that get it, and in this case, this sounds like this fits here. But once they get that number, like the members didn't, or the patients didn't realize that they were getting billed for, you know, they thought they were getting a test or maybe eight for the month. But once they get that number, they just keep billing, you know, and then not providing. So it becomes it kind of goes into perpetual billing for services not rendered. And, you know, so that's something they don't think.
Yeah. And that's something that I'd be interested to see in the data, right? Because we don't know if that was happening, but it's probably a pretty good guess that if they were sending, and we don't know what the number was, but if they were sending eight tests to the patient for that given month, and again, we don't know what the time period is. The time period, you know, I'm going to guess that it was during at least the period of the PHE. I believe in September of 24 is when they kind of stopped a lot of the stuff that was out there with COVID testing. But it certainly does beg the question of how many repeat offenders were there, right? How many times were they rebilling for that? Because once you've got that information, you know, we see this in diabetic testing supplies, where once they get the patient's information, it's a race to the finish line, you know, every 30 days to bill for those supplies, you know, the lancets and the strips and the solution, all that. So, you know, it's a similar vein. So it'll be interesting to see what winds up happening. You know, it looks like there's a couple of people that were listed in the indictment, a doctor and then maybe the owner of the lab. I think we'll see, you know, what'll happen with that, whether there'll be a plea or a trial. Obviously, they didn't give these people an opportunity to just plead guilty. They indicted them and, you know, maybe they approached them and they said, no, we're not going to plead. And so they went to an indictment. You know, who knows? We'll see as the facts bear out. But, you know, it is interesting to see when you have 12 agencies involved in this, you know, how much investigative effort, you know, for 12 agencies. So, you know, you gotta kind of just look at that, because obviously, you know, every agency has their own purview of what they're authorized to investigate, what they're not authorized to investigate. So each agency has a sliver of things that are interesting to them. What I did, what I thought was interesting, they didn't have it in the press release. They didn't mention if the PRAC was involved, the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, which was created as a result of the PHE. They got a huge influx of money to fight fraud. And one of the PRAC's main goals is amalgamation of data. They, you know, they bring in the data from different sources. So I would not be surprised if the PRAC had some involvement in this. I don't know for sure. It's not in the press release. They didn't mention it. but for Sony agencies to be involved. And then if you're going to amalgamate that data, you really do need one central source of truth. So I will be interested to see what happens on this, because while the facts in the press release aren't all that interesting per se, I think some of the underlying things that could come out are going to be interesting. So we'll see what happens. So as always, Wade, good hanging with you.
Me too.
Matt had another broadcast to do. He's a very busy guy.
Yeah.
This is a good time. We can talk about him, because when he sees this, he could, you guys talked about me. So as always, good to see you. Matt, I know you're gonna watch this later. Good seeing you. As always, we enjoy everybody joining in and participating in these podcasts and the questions we get, the comments. We've got well over 60,000 followers now on LinkedIn as of the other day. And we appreciate everybody who tunes into the podcast, who gets it in their newsletter and gets it off LinkedIn. So we'll continue to put out this content. And we've got some great LinkedIn Lives coming up over the next couple of weeks and months. I'll be doing a part two with Dan Olson on data. We got a lot of great feedback on part one, so we'll be doing a part two. And I'll be speaking to Dan for those that are going to NAMPI. NAMPI is coming up in a couple of weeks, and we'll be doing a special edition OIG roundtable. It really won't be an OIG roundtable. It'll just be me and Dan. We're going to talk a little about NAMPI and the kind of things that go on with NAMPI for those that have never been there or aren't sure what it is, talk a little about that. So as always, we appreciate everybody tuning in, and we'll see you next week on the next OIG roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. We'll be right back.